you may have, or I suppose on the initiative, I'm sorry. Norma is a senior associate with the policy team of the secretariat. She started her career working as the current operations manager for a small municipality. Which one?
Clarington.
For a small municipality, Clarington, in the east end of the Toronto region, and has worked in both the planning approvals and policy divisions of the Ministry of Municipal Affairs and Housing. Norma held the pen for the development of the 1996 provincial policy statement and was a project lead for the background policy work and pilot testing of the development permit system. That's actually quite a big deal. Okay, she is now... that's like a whole new way of thinking about implementation. She is now leading the background work for the development of performance indicators for the growth plan for the Greater Golden Horseshoe. Norma attended Queen's and the University of Waterloo, and she's welcome anyway. Mike Logan is a senior associate on the partnerships and consultation team at the Ontario Growth Secretariat. He's a registered professional planner with 10 years of experience working on environmental and infrastructure issues. Mike has worked in the public, private, and nonprofit sectors and attended both Queen's and Dalhousie. Okay, so welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have up and running yet, or? Thank you for having us today, and thank you for that introduction, and for all for making it out of this cold and snowy day. And finally, we made it, and hopefully our computer's running, and we'll get underway here. Trying to stall a little bit. We get some kind of visual, but as mentioned, Norma and I are both in the Ontario Growth Secretariat as part of the Ministry of Infrastructure at the province. And the OGS coordinates the Places to Grow initiative for the province. We're here to speak to you specifically more about the growth plan for the Greater Golden Horseshoe, which is a framework for implementing the Government of Ontario's vision for building stronger, prosperous communities and better national growth. So, the Greater Golden Horseshoe.
Any minute now.
There's a map of the Greater Golden Horseshoe, but I imagine that most of you are quite familiar with that. It's also on, there's also a depiction on the handouts that you have, which, yeah, this one here that you've held up, is probably the best one to take a look at. The Golden Horseshoe is a large region, of course, with Toronto at its center. On your map, the green area represents the green belt. Inside the green belt, there's between the Greenbelt and Lake Ontario is what we tend to refer to as the inner ring, and it's characterized, of course, by dense urban areas, typically. And outside of the Greenbelt, also part of the growth plan planning area, is what we would refer to often as the outer ring, more characterized by smaller and smaller cities, towns and villages, and rural areas as well. So it's a very diverse region. We're also growing very quickly. And I believe there's also a graphic on your handout of this one here, which generally depicts the type of population growth that we are expecting, or are experiencing, and are expecting into the future. And just to update the version that is on your handout, we are really expecting that by 2041, there will approximately be 13.5 million people and 6.2 million jobs located in the Greater Golden Horseshoe region. Currently, our population forecasts are right on track, actually. The 2011 census shows that the region's population is 9.1 million.
Okay, people who have a class in this room, where did the little my computer icon go?
If you click start.
Okay, so watch. So I'm clicking start.
It should be.
And then go to documents. But then how do I get
my documents?
My computer.
Left.
Yeah, left.
The other left?
Yeah.
This? There. Yeah. This. Okay. And this?
It's good.
Apple uses
it. The PowerPoint version would be preferable.
And then, just use the
thank you. So, population increase. Of course, growth in our region is not a new phenomenon. The Greater Golden Horseshoe has experienced rapid population growth since the 1950s. And as I'm sure all of you know, the post-war urban development patterns really do define our region to a great extent. Typically, there is a spatial separation between places where people live, work, shop, and play, and that has a lot of impacts to what the way we live, which I'm sure that I don't have to explain, but transit is hard to deliver. Low density development takes up a lot of our agricultural land and green spaces as well. Now, of course, growth is not a bad thing. It is a sign of a healthy region, but failure to plan for growth in a sustainable way actually can threaten our economic competitiveness, our quality of life, and also the conservation of our environment. And so planning for this growth wisely it will really put us on a good course for a strong economy, healthy environment, and a high quality of life. The growth plan for the Greater Golden Horseshoe, which I have brought a couple of copies here, and I imagine that some of you are familiar with the document, but you're welcome to take a look at that, and a couple of you at least can have a copy today. The growth plan was the first plan released under the Places to Grow initiative back in June of 2006. And the plan does aim to really manage that rapid urban growth that we're seeing. The plan looks beyond the boundaries of any single municipality and addresses the challenges faced by the region as a whole. There are actually 110 municipalities in the Greater Golden Horseshoe area, and so a coordinated approach is quite needed and necessary. But it does respect and promote the role of municipalities in articulating their own unique community vision and by providing a framework for municipal implementation of growth policies. The plan has several guiding principles, including creating compact communities, supporting a strong economy, and efficiently using land and infrastructure, and protecting agricultural land and natural areas. The Places to Grow Act, passed in 2005, is the legislation that enables the provincial government to develop regional growth plans in Ontario. The Act requires that all land use planning decisions conform to a growth plan's policies. This includes decisions not only by municipalities in the province, but also by the Ontario Municipal Board. Policies of the growth plan do apply across the Greater Golden Horseshoe, and the document does need to be read as a cohesive document. The Places to Grow Act, just to put this in a little bit of context with the planning system in general, the Places to Grow Act and any of the growth plans that are created by the province are part of the land use planning system. The Planning Act, as you know, provides the legislative framework for the system as a whole. The provincial policy statement then establishes province-wide planning policies, articulates provincial interest in land use matters, and requires that municipalities and other decision makers be consistent with those policies and interests in their decision making about planning matters. Provincial plans, like the Greenbelt Plan, like growth plans, they provide provincial direction for specific geographic areas. Now, as you can imagine, creating a growth plan and successfully implementing it are challenging tasks. Planning in general is a challenging task, and growth planning and growth management, I think, is even more so. They're complex issues, and they touch on many aspects of real life that matter, obviously, to everyone. They include traffic congestion, infrastructure, social services, municipal financing, taxing, and more. The complex issues affect a variety of stakeholders with very diverse, often entrenched views. And many of these stakeholders don't really naturally work together. So example, these are some of the challenges that we face in growth management. So to address these challenges, a careful and deliberate approach was taken to creating the plan that lasted from 2001 all the way to 2006. Implementation is still ongoing, of course, and the plan continues to be amended as necessary. Each amendment has to follow the process that is in fact set out by the Places to Grow Act. The policies of the growth plan themselves were produced through extensive consultation, as I mentioned, with stakeholders and the public. A series of papers were released for public discussion and feedback and consultation before the actual growth plan was released. Public and stakeholder consultation and engagement continues to be constant throughout all phases. For example, we're actually consulting right now on a second proposed amendment to the growth plan. And I have brought a couple of copies of that as well if you want to take a look. Information about that on our website too. Just want to pass over to my colleague Norma, who's going to tell you a little bit about some of the specific policies.
Thanks. So one thing that's really unique about the growth plan, and I think sets it apart from other provincial policies, is that Schedule 3 and Schedule 7 of the growth plan contain forecasts about expected growth in the period to 2031 for the existing plan. And that's something that's really unique, and it's meant to deal with the extreme growth pressures that are being faced in this area. So the plan requires that upper-tier municipalities have to meet those growth projections, plan on the basis of those growth projections, and pass allocate growth to their lower-tier municipalities as well. And it's not just population growth, it's also employment growth. And I think that's an interesting thing, because municipalities always think they're going to get more employment growth than they actually will get. So the growth plan requires the Minister of Infrastructure to review those forecasts every 5 years, and the document that Mike showed you is an amendment to the growth plan to deal with those new population projections. One other really important feature of the growth plan is that we're trying to concentrate growth in existing built-up areas rather than promoting expansion of settlement areas. This is a really key feature of the growth plan. But starting in 2015 and for every year thereafter, 40% of new development going into each municipality across the Greater Golden Horseshoe has to be concentrated in the built-up area. And you can see on the red line is the built-up area. So the extent of urban development in 2006 was what was the basis for delineating about that. It was quite a comprehensive methodology, and there's more information on that methodology on our website. And of course, one of the big advantages of intensification is instead of having to extend services, we make the best use of the services that are there now. And also preserve the farmland that's really important in this part of the country. So another important feature of the growth plan is that it really promotes complete communities. Communities where you can walk to get to meet your daily needs. Communities that have a mix of land use and easy access to local stores and services and amenities, and a real range of housing and transportation choices. I was just reading about one small town in the municipality I used to work in that was all upset because a four-story apartment building was going to be built. So the next important feature of the growth plan is that it identifies 25 existing and emerging downtowns as urban growth centers. And these areas that are spread across the region are intended to act as growth poles for those areas. Each have minimum density targets that have been set up in the growth plan, and they're going to be focal points for new development, including regional services and institutions. And there are examples of that in a lot of the urban growth centers now. The City of Oshawa has a courthouse. University of Waterloo has the University of Waterloo's satellite campus. So a lot of really good developments happening in those urban growth centers now. And they're also intended to be designed as vibrant mixed-use places that support walking and transit. So this slide just shows you one example of how infill development supporting a mix of land uses can help to increase density. The next important part of the growth plan is that urban growth centers are required to achieve densities of either 150 200 or 400 people and jobs per hectare by 2031, depending on where they're located. So obviously ones in the city of Toronto will have higher densities, and some in the outer ring area on the other side of the greenbelt will have lower densities and less population. But these illustrations show what the same street could look like if developed to 150 people and jobs per hectare, 200, and then 400. Sorry you can't see it very well. Can you see the clip? Another really important thing is to make really good use of the land that's already designated for development. Quite often we've seen single family, bungalowburbia, I call it, single family detached dwellings, that's all. So new development in greenfield areas has to be built to a minimum density of 50 people and jobs per hectare. And we're hoping that those communities will also support a range of housing choices, detached, townhouse, low-rise, and high-rise development. Because that's really important to support transportation choices and just make the communities more vital. One thing is, though, that if there is natural heritage features that have been protected through the provincial policy statement, those areas can be netted out for density calculations. The growth plan also requires municipalities to plan for lands to accommodate forecasted employment. Lands must accommodate a mix of employment types, and any application to convert employment uses to other uses must be evaluated against pretty strict criteria. And it's really important to understand that even though retail is a really important use, and retail jobs are included in the growth plan forecasts, major retail uses are considered non-employment uses for the purposes of employment land conversion. So a big box retail proposal would have to justify the conversion of employment lands for that purpose. Another really important, really unique thing about the growth plan is that because the Ministry of Infrastructure...
Can we ask a question in between?
Could we share?
What are some of the reasons that would legitimate this conversion from employment land to retail? Is there a list of reasons that they can use at the OMB?
The growth plan talks about the kinds of things that have to be considered. One of them, obviously, is you have to prove you have enough employment lands to generate or to deal with the employment you're forecasting. But municipalities may, it's section 226 sub 5 of the growth plan on page 18. Municipalities may permit conversion of lands within employment areas to non-employment uses only through a municipal comprehensive review where it's been demonstrated that there's a need for the conversion. The municipality will meet the employment forecasts allocated to the municipality through the growth plan. The conversion will not adversely affect the overall viability of the employment areas and achievement of the intensification target and density target and other policies of the plan. So that's the 40% intensification and 50 people and jobs per hectare. There's existing or planned infrastructure to accommodate the proposed conversion. The lands aren't required for over the long term for employment purposes for which they're designated, and cross-jurisdictional issues have been considered. So, and for the purpose of this policy, major retail are considered non-employment uses. And municipal comprehensive review is defined in the growth plan. It's an official plan review initiated by a municipality, so it can't be initiated by a developer.
Thanks.
So that's been a big issue with some of these growth plan areas. So the next thing that's unique about the growth plan is that money for infrastructure is also being looked at. So proposals for infrastructure improvements and funding have to conform with the growth plan as well. So that's a really important thing, that so we can direct the infrastructure funding to the areas where it's going to, where we're trying to deal with the most growth pressures. Transit investment is the first priority for moving people around the region, and highway investment will support efficient goods movement. The growth plan requires the coordination of water and wastewater infrastructure, as well as community infrastructure. Community infrastructure includes land and buildings that provide services for health, education, social, cultural activities, security and safety, and affordable housing.
Can I ask a question on that point? I live in 905 in Markham, in fact, and I'm sure all of these municipalities there struggling with the dichotomy that they're meeting their growth population targets, but the transit investment is way behind, and so congestion. But I presume the province is aware of this problem, but do you have any comments on resolution? Because the big move keeps getting pushed out further and further and further. Mm-hmm. Stuff that used to be in the 15-year plan is now in the 25-year plan.
Yeah. It's a real issue. And I think the way the growth plan can contribute to the achievement of our transit objectives is to design communities where people can take transit. So once transit's available, it's also easier for people to walk, to carpool. There's a mix of land uses, theoretically, in communities, so people can actually work in the area they live in. So we're hoping that some of those things will take some of the pressure off.
But I think what's going to happen is somebody's probably going to revolt and not allow more development, so deliberately fall behind their growth plan. Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting point, because the growth plan isn't generating the demand for growth. It's managing the growth. So those forecasts set out in the growth plan we haven't said, we're going to make you take this number of people. We're saying, we're expecting you to have pressures for development for this number of people, and this is how you can accommodate that growth. And you can't go beyond that growth. So it's a different, the growth plan doesn't generate the growth pressures, but it helps municipalities manage that pressure. And to do it in a way that will allow easy transition to transit when it's available. So you start with bus, and you go to higher order transit. And Metrolinx is working with us to focus the growth in areas where transit's proposed.
I just wanted to add on your comments about transportation. I mean, Review and Markham Mill, like, you can't see the progress of the next project along Highway 7, which is where the majority of the employment lines are. So I mean, at least that's. I mean, there's crazy.
A little bit.
There's a crazy traffic.
But
now.
You need all day go service. You need things that aren't.
But it's a step
in
the right direction.
Yeah.
Slowly.
Yeah. So we're hoping we're going in the right direction. the next thing that's the policy deals with is protecting what's valuable. Now, the growth plan doesn't have a lot about agriculture or natural heritage or mineral aggregates. We build on the policies in the provincial policy statement, which have lots of policies on those issues. But what the growth plan tries to do is, by focusing growth in intensification areas and promoting denser development in lands that are already designated, is to protect the outlying natural heritage areas and aggregates and mineral and agricultural lands. And it also works hand in hand with the Lakes and Creeks Protection Plan and the Greenbelt Plan to establish areas where growth is going to be concentrated and growth areas where other features are going to be protected. So it's been 5 years, well, it's been a little more than 5 years now since the growth plan was in effect. So we've done some work to find out how we're doing in terms of implementation. The growth secretariat continually tracks how municipal policies perform with the growth plan. And in 2011, we researched the growth plan's progress in four themed areas: curbing sprawl, revitalizing downtowns, creating complete communities, and increasing transportation choice. While we're still a long way from seeing full implementation, just because of the timeline of getting municipal official plans updated, we're already seeing promising trends in these areas. This shows shows how many municipalities have undertaken official plan amendments to bring official plans into conformity with the growth plan. So all upper and single-tier municipalities have now adopted an official plan amendment to achieve conformity, but not all are in effect. As with most planning issues, the Interior Municipal Board is a great venue for dealing with planning disputes, and there are quite a few amendments that have been appealed to the board. In some cases, the reason for the appeal has nothing to do with the growth plan. It's just that part of the amendment happened to deal with something else that was appealed. The counties of Northumberland and Dufferin don't have their own official plans, but they've completed growth management strategies. And the City of Toronto's official plan review is in progress. So one of the things we looked at is the statistics about how communities' plans since 2006 are being planned. And we found that those communities are more dense now and need less land than those planned before 2006. An increase in greenfield density is most evident in municipalities south of the Greenbelt, or sorry, beyond the Greenbelt. Statistics show that 67% of new residential uses added to the region between June 2009 and 2010 were located in the built-up area. That's really good news for us. And at the same time, less rural land is being redesignated for future urban uses within the Greater Golden Horseshoe. To accommodate urban growth till 2031, an additional 8,000 to 10,000 hectares of rural and agricultural land is proposed to be redesignated for urban land use. All 25 urban growth centers have been delineated in official plans, and we're already seeing downtowns in the region revitalizing, as I said earlier. Public institutions are leading the revitalization efforts in places like Oshawa and Kitchener, and new major office development is strong in some centers such as Markham Center and downtown Toronto. And new uses are anchoring other urban growth centers like downtown Pickering. One measurement of complete communities is housing options available to the residents. Since different housing forms tend to suit different people at different stages of their lives, providing greater choice means a community is more suitable for a greater range of people. The mix of new housing types being built across the Greater Golden Horseshoe is becoming more balanced. While still important and significant, single detached dwelling has become less dominant, and other forms of ground-related and multi-residential housing have become more common across the region, especially in municipalities outside the Greater Toronto area. I think that's really important. Significant increases in higher densities are being seen in Burlington, Mississauga, Waterloo, Kitchener, and Markham. Denser forms of ground-related housing, such as townhouses and semi-detached houses, are being seen in places like Oshawa, St. Catharines, Cambridge, Newmarket, Brantford, Guelph, and Peterborough. Yes?
I have a question regarding the housing types. I was wondering to what extent the province can actually direct the development in terms of providing housing for different people.
There's an affordable housing strategy that's been produced by the Ministry of Housing, so that's a separate, and housing is also dealt with through the provincial policy statement. But the contribution of the growth plan is the density targets. So when you're dealing with 50 people and jobs per hectare, that's a denser form of development. And also, I guess, in urban growth centers with those really higher density targets in the intensification areas, that's how the growth plan is contributing.
Just related to housing as well. So you mentioned that in the outer ring, there's a densification sort of intensification target. And I'm just wondering what you see as projected housing mix, like past 2010, you know, into the next 10 years or so. And in light of what you said about maybe some residents are opposed to apartments and high rises, do you see any kind of issues with implementation?
This side of the chart deals with housing in the outer ring. So this is what we've been seeing. 71% single before 2005, and now 59% single. So that's been a pretty important trend. You can see the row housing is increasing, the apartment, and also semis. Semis are about the same.
Do you see this trend continuing? Or
I would say so.
And that the local residents would generally be okay with that kind of trend?
I think when you see the units people are buying in the city of Toronto, I was reading an article today in the paper that said young people are coming downtown, and I think that trend is happening. It's happening in the north. People move to downtown to St. Marie because there's more choice of activity, and so I think we're going to see. I mean, I'm not a demographer, but I think that trend is going to continue for several reasons. One is price, one is policy, and one is just people's choices. I think that people are seeing the need for a broader range of housing so that all generations can live in the same way.
Do you have the numbers, not the numbers exact, but so do you have the, So is the absolute numbers of building activities, have they stayed the same? Because this is a percentage, so we don't know if there has been still the same amount of single family dwellings being built, and the condominium market has increased, or has the absolute numbers of single family dwellings decreased?
I don't have that information because this is across the Greater Golden Horseshoe.
Right.
But I think that, you know, the, certainly the number of new buildings being built has not gone down. And
I don't know.
Yes,
so what one would, I mean, these statistics are based on, these calculations are based on real numbers, so where would one get those numbers?
The population numbers.
Yeah, so the population is going up. We can get you that information if you leave us your card.
And this is units or square meterage?
It's housing, units.
Units, and regardless of size.
Mm-hmm. So a condo unit counts the same as a single detached unit. And this is based on ASPA, property assessment data. So this is new units being built, and building permit data from the municipality. So it's pretty accurate. But I just from the data I've seen, and I haven't seen it, I haven't looked at this recently, but I would say that the certainly the new housing starts, I would say the number of singles has gone down. And the other units have gone up relatively. But I can, if you give me your card, I'll give you that information. So the any other questions before we move on? You can see the trend on the ground. Significant increases in higher density housing forms are being seen in Burlington, Mississauga, Waterloo, Kitchener, and Markham. Denser forms of ground-related housing, such as townhouses and semi-detached homes, are being seen in places such as Oshawa, St. Catharines, Cambridge, Newmarket, Brantford, Guelph, and Peterborough. So even in the outer ring, this is happening. Another important thing is that transit ridership has increased throughout the plan area. Metrolinx has been created and has really released a big move, the issue you raised earlier. Significant transit funding has been committed by the province to support growth plan objectives. You can see the increase in ridership. So now Mike's going to take you through other studies that have been done to model the impacts of the growth plan.
Thanks, Norma. So, while there obviously are indicators that point to early success, as Norma has mentioned, it will be many years before the fully viable growth plan policies can be observed, obviously. We have done computer modeling as well to understand how the growth plan policies could impact future land development and travel patterns. And that's just what I wanted to tell you a little bit about now. The model that we developed and use compares two future scenarios. The first is a no growth plan scenario, as if the growth plan had never come into effect. And the second scenario is a growth plan scenario, which where the land use and transportation policies of the growth plan and the big move are assumed to be fully implemented. Remember, the model results are conceptual and don't actually represent development that has occurred after 2006. The first finding of our modeling was that it suggests that under the growth plan, two-thirds less greenfield land will be converted to urban uses, and more than half of all the new development will be accommodated through intensification of existing built-up areas. In addition, average urban density will in fact be 20% higher than it would be if the growth plan had never come into effect. These key results can actually be mapped as well, which we've done, to illustrate the potential conversion of greenfield land into urban uses. These maps, again, are for demonstration purposes and don't indicate or endorse specific location of development. This first map depicts what the urban area will likely look like in 2031 if all of the growth plan and big move policies are implemented. Purple area on the map is the urban area as it was in 2006, which we call the built-up area. The orange area is new urban land developed between 2006 and 2031, so this is a 2031 viewpoint. The green area, again, is the green belt, and the beige area is the other land and area within the growth plan planning area. you compare that to the no growth plant scenario. And hope the colors are okay to see, but it's also on your handout as well. If it seems probably easier to look at that one from your seat. Again, the colors represent the same ideas. You can see quite a bit more urban development, obviously, under the two scenarios, or more urban development if the growth plan in Big Move are not interested. Interesting, we've also modeled increasing transportation choice and how that impacts transportation patterns within the region. And it's important to realize that trips by automobile or population growth in the region means that by 2031, people will still need to make more trips by car in 2006 under both scenarios. So car trips will actually increase whether or not the growth plan is implemented and the Big Move as well. However, there's a significant shift from car trips to sustainable trips, what we call sustainable trips. Those include walking, cycling, and transit under the growth plan scenario. Some of the details are there. Related to that, of course, is actual trip time. Population growth will mean increased traffic congestion, even if the growth plan and the Big Move are implemented. But the additional delay is much smaller if the policies of the growth plan and the Big Move are implemented than if they're not. In this particular example, it's a complex thing to understand, but in this particular example, a 30-minute car trip in 2006 is projected to take 31.5 minutes in 2031, so a little bit longer, under the growth plan scenario. If there is, in the no growth plan scenario, the same trip would take 44 minutes. So quite a bit of additional delay if the growth plan and the Big Move are not implemented.
Could you quickly comment on why under either scenario there would be a delay nevertheless? Comment on maybe a main factor that has contributed to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when we talk about what we're trying to achieve and less car trips in general, but simply the population increase in the region will mean increased traffic delay. It's just a function of the number of trips that people will need to take it because there are so many more people.
And it's also truck traffic.
Truck traffic as well. Then if you look at the numbers also, numbers also show that this is important, it's sort of related to that other slide as well, that your trip length is actually going to go, it's still going to be more, but it's going to be a lot less more.
It seems to suggest to me, at least a little bit, that our transit development is really lagging behind population growth. Can I maybe make that sort of suggestion?
Well, that doesn't follow from this analysis. This analysis assumes that all of the Big Move is implemented. That's what these two scenarios represent. So if no transit investment and no growth plan policies versus full implementation of both. So I mean that may be happening, and Norman spoke to that a little bit a minute ago, but that's separate from this kind of model. So it's important that we certainly need that transit infrastructure, but this particular result is assuming that transit infrastructure is already there.
And it's certainly higher than if municipalities were left to fend for themselves to build transit without the Build Move and Metrolink's sort of coordinated approach to transit.
Right. Okay. Does your model take into account other forms of transportation, or is that something that's by the Big Move?
Other forms include like walking and cycling and that kind of
public
thing.
Transportation.
Yes, yeah. It the model accounts for all of those types. We're sort of the graphics that we presented sort of concentrate on traffic congestion, but the difference between the scenarios is of course many of the trips are taken by public transit, walking, cycling, and those kinds of sustainable trips. So the model includes all of those things. So, I mentioned a few minutes ago that consultation on the policy is really important. policy on, or development of the policy, changes to the policy through amendments. But engagement with stakeholders and the public is needed even when we're not talking about policy changes, when we're just talking about implementing the policy. We focus heavily on training stakeholders, working with stakeholders, and building and maintaining partnerships with credible organizations to provide, we provide tools and help them to provide tools and resources that effectively convey the concepts that are dealt with in the growth plan. And we help stakeholders to implement the policies of the growth plan. So stakeholders include all kinds of groups, municipalities, the development industry, academic groups that that are interested in the same issues, environmental NGOs. We really work with a lot of people to help them understand the policies and in fact implement the policies. The growth plan, of course, is primarily a land use planning document, but it's very interesting in that it affects everyone. Everyone has a role to play in implementing this policy. Various sectors and professionals have a really important role to play in achieving the goals of the policy. These include economists and architects, designers, engineers, lawyers. Kind of everyone has their own role to play, as I said. These groups also need to understand the policies and how to implement them in their work. I did mention that we do work with stakeholders, providing lots of resources to them, and you can invite you to actually go and check those things out. We've created a lot of resources for, you know, really engaged stakeholders and also the public who are interested in understanding the objectives of the growth plan. Our resources include mapping case studies that illustrate how some of the policies could be implemented, videos. We have all kinds of programs and resources for people. As an example, there are actual, you can download images from our image bank that we have to include in your own presentations. You can actually find that helpful in school or in your career. And you can download those at no cost and just provide us credit and you're free to use those. We also have 9 currently, and in another week or so, we hope it's going to be 11 urban form case studies on completed development projects that illustrate how key growth plan policies have been, may be achieved in the future, or in some of them actually deal with policies that have been achieved within the Greater Golden Horseshoe. And if you'd like to subscribe to our mailing list, we can also send you updates when those new growth, or when those new case studies are released, and other ongoing news about our consultation and other news about the growth plan, and also our growth plan for Renewable Ontario. So that was our presentation so far, but we'd be delighted to answer any more questions that you have.
Well, I have another question. Like, the Canadian Urban Institute just came out with this report that I'm sure you've read about. They seem to be saying the biggest, we're doing a lot of good things, but the biggest problem we've got is still out in 905 land, not enough, too much segregation of employment lands versus residential. So, and often these employment lands are poorly served by transits in the huge congestion areas. You know, downtown Toronto does it well. You've got transit, you've got condos, you've got offices, but a large parts of the 905s aren't like that. They're mono-use area. What are your comments on that?
Well, initially, I'll jump in as well, but I mean, initially, obviously planning is a long-term endeavor. And so, yeah, agree that that we would like to see more employment lands, more office areas, be connected to transit, be in mixed-use communities, be closer to where people live. And we are seeing that. We didn't really talk about what we're seeing in terms of employment lands, but we are seeing progress on a number of the key indicators in the growth plan.
I think they're suggesting that's got to be strengthened.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not speaking for them, but that's what they're suggesting.
And I think it's, as municipalities continue to update their official plans every 5 years, they're going to see, like a lot of these employment lands have been designated for 20, 30 years, and in some cases they're in the wrong area. So we saw when we were doing some work in Simcoe that there's lots of employment land, but it's not all in the right spot. So those municipalities may want to look at those employment areas and see if it's better to encourage those uses to move to sort of easier areas that are easier to service with transit, for example. So as municipalities update their official plans, they'll be looking at all these issues comprehensively. And they may look at also how to serve the employment areas better with transit.
So the talking the area around Pearson Airport, in hindsight, very bad. 404 and 407 area, hindsight, very bad, according to the report.
Sure. I haven't read that report. But I do know that that Metrolinx is looking at all those issues when it's looking at this new transit line. So, for example, there's a transit line going to the airport now, and that will solve some of the issues.
It doesn't serve workers.
No, I know. I know this is an issue that's been raised a lot in the past few years, and I'm sure Metrolinx is aware of it and is trying to deal with it. But it's a good point.
The growth plan does speak about employment areas in the same way as residential areas, yeah. That they need to be walkable, mixed-use communities. We would like to see higher quality design in employment areas as well, and they're all pieces of the puzzle that will obviously take time to implement.
There's a question over here.
Something that I found interesting when I was going through the plan is that there's no maximum or target densities for the urban growth centers. That it's basically unlimited growth is allowable in these centers. And I live near Young and Eglinton, and I've become sort of involved in going to public meetings there and seeing what's going on.
Yep.
And what's happening there and further south is everything is being turned into towers, because if the OMB is supporting very, very dense developments, everything is incredibly valuable. So where's the balance between keeping the community services and green space and density in these nodes? I see the province playing a role in making sure that we don't go too far in the center's comments.
The growth plan talks about minimum densities, and the municipalities have to conform with that minimum density. But they also take other considerations into account when looking at the maximum densities. So they'll be looking at the capacity of their transit, their roads, their water and sewage services, the fire department, all the services as well, schools.
The OMB isn't listening to what the city is saying. The city is saying, we want it no higher than this, yeah. Or no more dense than this. And the developers are living at the OMB saying, no, this is a new growth center.
The OMB is here in de novo, so it deals with the evidence that's presented to it. And
exactly. So, yeah. But they're a creature of the province, and they have to comply with the growth plan. So the province has a responsibility in making sure the OMB doesn't go beyond what is intended for.
I guess the only way the growth plan would apply to this is if they were getting to the forecast peak. So if the city could argue that if all of this development's happening, they're going to exceed their allocated growth, that would be a way that the growth plan would have an impact. But
if you have all your growth in one square kilometer, mm-hmm. That's also not a good thing.
No. Okay. So, but that's a municipal council decision, and the intermunicipal board.
I would add it. Just that the growth plan doesn't replace good planning.
Yes, right? Exactly.
It's a tool. But it's a part of good planning.
Provincial level, so it trumps local policy.
But it sets a minimum. It doesn't require 100-story towers. In fact, we don't really encourage that kind of thing.
No, and there's also policies in the growth plan that talk about transition between intensification areas and stable neighborhoods and those kinds of things as well. So it's a piece of the planning puzzle, but there's lots of opportunity for the municipalities to do good planning, right?
Mm-hmm.
Follow-up here. When you reviewed the plan last year, there's a number of issues, and this is certainly one of the most prominent, the most explicit issue, where the Places to Grow Act is used by developers in front of the OMB strategically in order to allow to build up and build up and build up. And when you look along King Street, for example, with the streetcar capacity there, when you look at Markham, same problem. When you look at around the province at certain places where this intensification is taking place. How did internal discussions around these issues, are there any internal discussions around this, or is it just you know that, or, I mean, how do you address this internally? These problems that we discuss in Markham, in Toronto, and other places where the services are not in sync with the development pressures in that the already built up place, which is conforming to the places to Grow Act and the plan. So it's doing the right things, but not all parts are playing along the game, such as, you know, transit, sewage, and so on, schools.
The growth plan sets broad brush policy directions, and so does the provincial policy statement. And the municipal official plan is the vehicle for all those things to be worked through as they apply to specific municipalities. So that it's through the development of the official plan that the residents have the opportunity to provide input into that official plan as well. So the growth plan sets certain parameters, but there are a lot of different ways to accommodate the growth that's being proposed and to meet the 50 people and jobs per hectare target and the 40% intensification target. That doesn't require high rises. It doesn't require really intense development. It requires, like, a community like the Junction would meet the growth plan requirements. And that's pretty low rise. So it's not that the growth plan requires dense development. It's that maybe developers are making a case at the board that's not being refuted. I don't know. I haven't looked at each of the decisions on these matters, but the growth plan doesn't require really high buildings. It's not that's sort of a
maybe the question was misunderstood. We know that, right? Mm-hmm. That the growth plan is not, you know, it's in sync with the municipal decisions of where to grow and so on. Mm-hmm. My question was, is there any discussions of the unintended consequences of the official of the growth plan internally? Mm-hmm. Do you have any internal discussions on the unintended consequences of the plan?
We'll be undertaking the review of the growth plan. We have to start it by 2016. So right now we're just now starting to look at the effects of the growth plan, and the statistics that we showed you earlier were part of the initial discussion or the initial work we did. And that chart we showed you a little while ago with the change in the mix of land use, but that chart doesn't show a preponderance of really high density. It's mostly townhouses, apartments, low rise. So we will be talking about the impacts of the growth plan. We'll be setting up performance measures. The growth plan provides for the development of performance indicators to measure the effectiveness of the growth plan. And we will be looking at developing those performance indicators before the growth plan 10-year review happens in 2016. So we will be looking at all these issues. We'll be consulting broadly with stakeholders on the draft growth plan amendment. So there will be lots of consultation and lots of opportunities for those issues to be raised.
Yes. One of the things that, and this came up in a transit talk we had a couple months ago, one of the things that strikes me is that Toronto looks like a region. Places to Grow looks like a regional plan. There's a governance issue. There's a lack of oversight. The whole idea of the OMB, the idea that municipalities can do their own planning, but we all know that the OMB is there for municipal plans to be based on provincial. Maybe you can talk about this a little bit, where the teeth is it provincial policy statement, is it Places to Grow? So I'm wondering, what kind of challenges do you see in having something like a vision, like Places to Grow, without any sort of governance structure that covers the entire region? I mean, you talk about 110 municipalities competing for development charges and property taxes. Where's the thing that holds it all together?
I think there are a lot of informal structures. The regional planning commissioners get together and talk. MetroLinx provides a forum for discussions like that. You know, there's an organization of county planners. There are a lot of different organizations where people, mayors of all the big cities, get together periodically. So that's one forum for the discussion of these things. In fact, the urban growth centers were the result of a submission by the planners from a lot of the areas in the Greater Golden Horseshoe. So they identified the need for promoting those urban growth centers. So we do listen a lot to the experts around. But in terms of a forum for coordinating land use planning decisions, I guess the growth plan provides the general framework, and so does the provincial policy statement. But the green belt, the growth plan, the Lake Simcoe Protection Plan, all those provincial plans do provide some guidance in that regard. But you're right, it is up to the local councils to decide exactly how they conform and exactly how they are consistent with the PPS and how they actually take the policies and tailor them to local circumstances through the official plan. So I hope I answered that question. I sort of circled around it. There's no Council of Greater Toronto Commissioners of Planning, for example. And there's no overseeing political body. But that's sort of in keeping with the philosophy of planning reform, where the power of policy and municipalities implement it.
I'm amused by the fact that probably, we're... like this particular group is 100% behind the philosophy of this, mm-hmm. and you still get these very tricky questions. Mm-hmm. I wonder what it's like for you if you go to a group of developers or whatever. You have a local meeting of people who are upset about this. It must be hell for you. But so having said this, I'm going to ask another tricky question. At a different scale, and this governance issue and the height issue mm-hmm. already sort of highlighted that, but if you could go back one slide. And this actually came out in the discussion on Metro Morning about that plan that was already the report from the CUI that was mentioned.
Oh, yeah.
The upper, these two photographs up there, which on paper look like you've achieved the objectives. This is an accomplishment to create something out of almost nothing. But the issues highlighted in the debate there about this report, which I find really, the more I think about it, really difficult to think through, is whether the mandate of the growth plan is actually going to produce more problems in the end than solutions, or the wrong kinds of wrong kinds of solutions. And here there are two issues here. Just one is this. This doesn't convince me at all on the right-hand side. It doesn't convince me aesthetically. Mm-hmm. It is not clear to me whether this is functionally working. This doesn't look like a city. It just looks like a kid has taken three blocks and put them together. There's nothing organic about this. There are no streetscapes. There is no sense of mm-hmm. home or, any of place. It's just a developer's dream of putting as much possible density. It doesn't have to be high. That's a fetish, mm-hmm. high, but it doesn't have to be that. It could be, other forms of density. But it doesn't satisfy even the minimal requirements for aesthetics and usability and human scale and these sort of things. And so I'm wondering in all these 25 places to grow, that these 25 growth centers, whether we're going to produce an awful environment, which when the next economic downturn happens, it's going to be, people will run from these places because nobody can survive there, really, because there's nothing there. These places are living on very high energy inputs. They're living on extremely, high computer commuter radius. The fact that you create transportation hubs doesn't mean that people will come there from close by. It just means that you're actually creating exponentially larger radius for whatever the plural of radius is, radii, for people to be able to get there. So actually it doesn't mean that a place like this is any more sustainable and any better in meeting the needs of future generations than what we have now. That's one issue. The other issue is resilience, and I mean it in the most positive way I can use that term. You know, the North American suburb has a lot of disadvantages, a lot, and that's why we all want to change them, and you want to build better suburbs. But the advantage that North American suburbs have as opposed to this sort of thing, and as opposed to commercial lands that are built by developers very quickly, very cheap construction of big structures that you could, big boxes you could put anything in. North American suburb, which is with its wood frame construction, has the advantage of being incredibly flexible in being, you know, you can rebuild it all the time. These suburban houses, they're constantly under construction. They can be retrofitted for all kinds of things. We now know that the modern buildings of the last half century, the towers, have huge problems of being, it's difficult to retrofit them, it's very expensive. The next generation, even worse, because they're flimsy, they don't have the concrete strength of the towers, and they don't have the flexibility of the wood frame North American suburb. So what we're actually building here is a fast way for developers to get rich on high densities, short amortization times, and unspecified futures. This is not city building, this is developer accumulation policy. And I was wondering whether that goes back to this, this question of, are you building in question of resilience, questions of how a piece of place like this going to look in 15 years? Is this a community, or is it just those building blocks that a three-year-old has put together into a sandbox?
So that's a very good point, and I'd just like to start by saying that the growth plan builds on the policies of the provincial policy statement, and that's undergoing a review right now. So there are a lot of additions of words like resilience. There's they deal with things like climate change, like walkable communities, livable streets, that kind of. So the growth plan builds on that framework and adds things like density provisions and TARC and population forecasts and things like that. But so all this thing has to be read together. So the growth plan's not advocating those towers or the tiny condo units. That's a way of dealing with really high growth pressures in the city of Toronto where they don't have any greenfield. I mean, that's one big thing. But I think it's important. The other half of that is in terms of sustainability and resilience is to make sure that we have enough agricultural land left to grow our own food and not be, So that's why the green belt was created, and that's why the growth plan is really focusing on increasing the densities to the extent that's possible, so that we don't have to keep on gobbling up farmland and natural heritage areas, and we don't have to keep extending infrastructure, and we don't. So there's a real trade-off here and a balance. 3.5 million people are coming here before 2031, and we have to be able to accommodate them. So it's a real balancing act. But we as I say, I agree with you. I don't like those towers.
I would just like to add, I mean, there is the image I've been using for myself to explain that to me is that I've seen these horrific images of the Vaughan Corporate Center. They look like a moonscape,
yeah.
Right? So compare that to St. Lawrence Market, or compare it to even the West Don Lands, which is, that's a city. That's city building.
That's right.
So this stuff is going to be built. We're going to see this rise in the next 5 years.
Yeah.
This is the worst possible way of building a city, but it's completely, absolutely compliant with the growth. So is there any process by which one can influence this?
Well, certainly, we'll take that point home. But I think it's really important to notice that those good examples you discussed are also fully compliant with the growth plan.
I know they are.
So the growth plan provides municipalities with the flexibility to make good decisions. It's just whether the Ontario Municipal Board is going to overturn those decisions, and that's an issue with the board.
I was just wondering, to build on the resilience and livability concepts, has the production capacity and jobs that could be created through urban agriculture being talked about at all as a way of replacing either way, we're still going to be losing a good chunk of our farmland around the area. Has that at all become a discussion?
We haven't talked about it. Urban agriculture is certainly something that we promote.
Right, but it's not actually like in there as a land use.
No. And there's some land use compatibility issues there. There's an issue. I mean, the other, I'm not speaking for the secretariat here just because I'm interested in agriculture. My view in terms of agricultural land is it's better to make the best use of the existing settlement area boundaries where you've already got infrastructure and services. And then reduce the pressure for expansion of the settlement area into the agricultural lands around it.
But either way, we're losing a lot of agricultural land in the next 10 years.
Well, I think urban agriculture is a really good idea, and there have been some really innovative examples of using like structures, apartments.
And Vancouver's currently actually trying to like put through green roofs. Farming right now, so I'm just wondering if there's any discussion going on.
Not within this. We haven't discussed it. I haven't discussed it with any of my colleagues in the secretariat, but I think it's something certainly to look at. We did talk about urban agriculture in the context of the PPS, provincial policy statement. But it's a good point. We'll bring it back for the 10-year review.
Is there any incentives for developers to build complete communities? Like, developers are just interested in making money, so they're doing whatever's most profitable. So how can you incentivize a developer that's interested in making money to build a complete community?
Developers have to conform with the official plan.
But if they're conforming to build tons of residential in the same area, they're still conforming, but they would also be conforming, building a complete community. So is there any way to like maybe speed up the approval process or something for, like, let's say they built a model community compared to what you're seeing now, it's not what you want to see. Mm-hmm. For the two developers, the one developer that's building the complete community isn't going to make as much money, and that's why they're not doing it. So how can you make it so it's still feasible for them?
I think bonusing has been used by some municipalities.
What's that?
Section 37 of the Planning Act provides that if the municipality has provisions in its official plan, they can increase density in exchange for the provision of community benefits. So when it's used well, that can get daycare centers and hockey arenas and libraries and things like that. Used improperly, it's let's make a deal planning.
What's the bonus? Is it monetary incentive?
It's set out in the official plan. It could be you can build 20% more density if you build a community center.
Mm-hmm. But so I argue that a complete community isn't necessarily less profitable than the other method of development.
No.
I worked in another municipality where the city would come forward and say, well, actually, you have the ability to have way more density. And they're going, really? And so they made more money by building
exactly
than the just straight single detached homes.
But in terms of like a high rise where you're building a bunch of units and they're all the exact same thing, it's simple, it's all the same thing. When you complete community, it's so varied, right? There's the cost associated with that that would sort of scare developers, in my opinion.
You mean a mixed use building?
Mixed use building. It's a lot more work. There's a bunch of different, all sorts of different sizes of units. It could be commercial, it could be employment.
Mm-hmm. But I think right now there's such a range of, there's such a variety of opportunity for residential development that I was reading this article that talked about how young people are flocking downtown because of all the amenities. So if you've got a residential building that has no facilities and another one that's got a fitness center and a community, like a library, and I'm sure that
faster and at a higher price.
Yeah.
If you're part of a community center, that's probably worth something in condo prices, right?
So in some ways, it's the market that determines what's going to sell. This is outside of our area of expertise. We're just blue sky in here.
There's also zoning regulations. Obviously.
Is there any way to speed up the process, though, for development that's a model community for what you would want? Is there any way to speed that up so there's less risk for the developer? Like, I know in terms of developing, like, let's say developing high-rise, their big concern is how long it's going to take for applying for the zoning or whatever permits they need, and there's a risk of the market turning. If they're going to sell $500,000 condos, they're worried 3 years down the road, are they still going to be able to sell them for that? So if you could speed up the process for developers that are building these model communities, you could eliminate risk without having to give a monetary incentive. You're just giving a sort of timely incentive.
Well, if a proposal conforms with the official plan and zoning bylaw,
yeah.
then it's just a matter of getting the site plan approval done, and it's quite often, or the condominium approval. So quite often, it's pretty fast. So the more you conform with the municipality's wishes in terms of planning, probably the faster the process will be. It's when you want to double the density or double the height, that's when you get into a lot more opposition. So that's the easy way.
I was just wondering, does anybody have a question who hasn't already asked a question? Okay, I'm just mindful of the time. It's 20 after 2, and I know a lot of people have class 7:30. So on behalf of the City Institute and the programs in planning at Environmental Studies, we are so pleased you came to speak for us. And I encourage everyone to have comments and thoughts to please forward your comments to the Board Secretary, because every single letter is read and
for sure
will help them as we move forward in thinking about the report.
Yes.
And
really, that's a very important point, because in preparation for the 10-year review, we want to know, because you're taking courses right now that are, you're sort of the leading edge of planning right now, so it'll be great to hear from all of you.
Great, thank you so much.
Are your emails on the website? Do you want to contact you? Or?
I can give you mine. It's mirma.forest@ontario.ca. 2 R's.
So 2 R's in Norma?
No, 2 R's in Forest.
Okay. Norma.forest.
Forest, F-O-R-R-E-S-T,
sure.
@ontario.ca.